today, if you are looking for some change, or maybe if you're not.
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
One of my favorite topics is change. I talk about it all the time. I'm not pretending that we're covering brand new ground in the discussion today, but I think there are a couple of things that we should talk about regarding change as we go through another year of life and to figure out what we're supposed to do to be just better people, but as a believer, to be more like we're supposed to be, like we were created to be. And so obviously, I mean, I'm saying we want to be more like something or another. That's change. And I guess one of the things I should emphasize at the beginning is that change is a lot more integral to the things that we do and desire than even we recognize. I mean, in ourselves, every time, for example, that we're setting a goal, we're introducing change. It's something we want to do that's different. We want to bring about a different result. So in personal terms, if I set a health goal, I need to get my heart rate down, or I need to lose some weight, or I need to become more fit, or I need to, I don't know, whatever. Then I'm saying I want to change my behaviors. I want to change my outcomes regarding health. People do it in spiritual terms. I want to read the Bible more. I want to pray longer. I want to do more evangelism. I want to learn more about what the scriptures mean. I want to, you know, study and get a degree in theology. And so I'm going to go to Criswell College where, anyway, you get the idea. Or relationally, I don't want to interact with my teenager this way anymore. I don't want to be this way as a parent like my parent was. I want as an office worker, I want to be in a better relationship with the people who work around me and not go into a tense setting every single day. Anytime you set a personal goal like that, what you're saying is, I want change. I want things to be different than the way they are right now. Professionally, it's the same thing. If you have ambition, it means you want things to change, whether that means ambitiously you're seeking a profit, or I want to become a more skilled type of person. I want to develop skills that I don't have now so that I have options and open doors that I didn't have before. I'm seeking a promotion, whatever it is. Those are changes. In others, by the way, when you look outside of yourself, at others, a lot of times change is indicated by what we see as erratic behavior. You know, there's just something off, you know. Oh, look, so-and-so showed up on time. What on earth happened with that? What we're saying is they've changed. Something's different. Or, you know, this guy's never late and he's late. What do you know? Something changed. Either we think the circumstance changed or the person changed, but we think something changed. People that we watch and know and are friends with or understand, we think in one way or another, and then suddenly they become withdrawn or sullen, or on the opposite side, unusually confident. It's like, well, you know, what changed? That's what we're wondering. Is some kind of change has been introduced? Even, and by the way, this one is, I think, interesting, and it's worth considering, especially today, for the things I want to talk about with change. Even efforts at maintenance, when we want to keep things the same. So I need to get up every day and do these things. Efforts at maintenance are a kind of change. We maintain things in order to redirect the path we would follow without the intervention of the regular maintenance. It's not just, and by the way, that's not even just changing an anticipated future, which wasn't going to be realized anyway. It's not that. I'm talking about in the present. It's a change of the path that we believe we are already on and down which we believe we would continue to go if we didn't have the intervention of maintenance right now to redirect us down this other path, the one that we want to stay on, but we wouldn't stay on if, just for example, we didn't get up in the morning and actually read the Bible every morning during our devotional time. that kind of maintenance effort is a desire for change from something we think would inevitably come down the road. When I'm teaching people how to preach, when I'm teaching young students how to preach, which is really how to teach with some heavy emphasis on rhetoric, but and also with the content of Scripture. That's, you know, what I'm always doing. When I do that, the whole system that I convey includes the understanding that you're trying to get to a point that actually has some value. You know, it's the old joke among preachers was, you know, how many points should a sermon have? And the answer is at least one. And that's not complicated. You used to have a point. But what kind of point is an important part of understanding how to frame your rhetoric and how to structure a sermon so that you get where you're trying to go. And so in my system, the way I analyze it with people, because of the way I understand human nature, I think there are three possible sort of domains where you have goals: an intellectual goal, which would be a propositional goal, just understand a sentence, just comprehend something. And that might be theological understanding, or it might be philosophical understanding, but it's changing a person's mind so that they understand something they didn't understand before. Or a cognitive kind of goal, which would be motivational, something that's ethical, for instance. So charge you with an understanding of why this is wrong so that you begin to carry a more internal and emotive sense of why you don't want to do this thing or you do want to do this thing that's so important. Or an imperative, you know, where at the end you're saying, you've got to do this, you've got to do it, and you're rousing up the crowd and getting them motivated to do it. Or it can be appetitive and emotive. And I mean by emotive, emotional in this case. And, appetitive sounds like you wouldn't want a sermon that's appetitive, but that's not true. There are certain sort of just gut-level desires that need to be motivated in people sometimes to do the right thing. And it can be emotional just to have the comeuppance that a lot of us have at movies or reading a certain book or a poem or something like that. We need to be confronted that way by some of the Scriptures. The Psalms do that to me a lot of times. And sometimes it's a psychological turn that takes place in those moments. But the point is, by the end of the message, I'm always saying to a person who's trying to speak, you don't just want to have said what you wanted to say. You want your audience to have experienced something intellectually, cognitively, appetitively, whatever it is, that helps them change. Know more, do more, think better, differently, feel differently. You want something to be different by the time you finish communicating the message. That I'm saying to you, these are, in my view, and I'm just talking about it in terms of ourselves and others and how we understand them, and now I'm saying it in terms of how we sort of approach communications, that these are, you know, sort of cryptic ways that we do talk about change, even when we're not talking about change. It's always the thing that's in the back of our minds or in the front of our efforts. There is, you know, a commonality in this effort, this understanding of what change is about. So while I'm talking about the preaching categories, or, you know, the categories of the self, where you have mind and spirit and, you know, appetite kind of stuff, it seems like the only one that would really be oriented to change is the volitional one, the cognitive one. That's what I was calling it a moment ago. But in reality, at a base level, all of them are. That's the point. So in an ultimate sense, they also all ought to be understood because of what they're trying to get at. Ideas that generate or reflect a difference, a will that's engaged in making a difference, a gut sense that's different than the one less shaped by the truth. The point is that in every creative, and that's an important word, in every creative or novel experience, we're either seeking change or exploring and avoiding it one way or another. We're always dealing with it. So what I want to do is talk about what kind of change is actually important and what we ought to be pursuing. And there's a topic here that I could avoid. I don't really want to avoid it. I'll clarify that in a minute. I could avoid because it's not important to the discussion. But it is important to the discussion because people who think about this on one side or the other will think it's the only thing that really matters when it comes down to change. So what I don't want us to do, and we're it's going to sound like we're doing this for a few minutes, but I'm doing the opposite. By doing it now, I'm avoiding the bogging down. I don't want the discussion to get bogged down in the debate about determinism and indeterminacy. And but I'm not just avoiding it again. You know, it's important to understand that it doesn't matter whether you're a determinist or you're not a determinist. I'll explain the words in just a minute, just enough, in case you're new to the podcast or, you know, new to anything I've ever said and haven't heard me talk about it before, so that you know what I mean by determinism and indeterminism. Very succinctly and briefly, I think. I'll clarify it in a second. But it does not matter which way you see the world, whether deterministically or indeterministically, if we talk about the kind of change we need to discuss that we go through as individuals or that we experience as individuals or that we cause as individuals. So again, it's not just an avoidance. Determinism, what I mean by it is, you know, it's the view that everything is already fixed. Everything's already determined, in other words, by prior sufficient causes, by prior conditions or circumstances, or the most important word, by prior causes. Everything's being brought about. And determinism can be materialistic. It can be deistic, like there's a God who set it in motion and now there's nothing can change it. It can be theistic, that God is actively involved in causing all the things to happen that happen. It can be fatalistic, where there's nothing different in the future that could come as a result of all of it, in whether it's theistic or not. And it can be atheistic. It can be any of those. It's just about whether you think real change is possible. Indeterminism, and by the way, just the way I said that, I know, makes you think, well, I thought you said determinism didn't matter and we're talking about change. It doesn't. And we'll come back and I'll explain in a moment why that is the case. Indeterminism, which is the, you know, obviously the opposite of determinism, it leaves room. I'm not just an indeterminist. I am an indeterminist. But it leaves room for some things, at least some things, which are not fixed. They're not determined by prior sufficient causes. So it leaves room, on one hand, for randomness, which doesn't do anybody any good. I mean, there's no desire to pursue randomness except just among, you know, mathematicians, cosmologists, people who just look at the universe and say, maybe that's the way it actually is, and they're trying to describe it. But there's not really a motive to pursue randomness. Anyway, the point is there's an open door for randomness if you're an indeterminist, or there's an open door for freedom of action or agency. And I mean by freedom in this case, radical freedom. And I have people ask me, what do you mean by radical? Why do you use that word? I mean, it goes against the flow of all the causation otherwise. Radical things are things that are against the way everything else is. So water is a radical because when it freezes, it expands. That's not normal. That's going against the common flow. That doesn't make ice a component of free will. It has nothing to do with that. I'm just describing the word radical in case somebody got confused out there. Anyway, the point is, in this massively important discussion, not because I choose for it to be important, but because change is a part of what we're constantly pursuing in life, as I described at the beginning. In this massively important discussion about change, it's important also to realize that both determinists and indeterminists have to, or in my view, at least ought to, deal with the kind of change I want us to consider. And it is an important discussion. I mean, overall, so in the area of determinism, let me clarify what I'm saying here. Overall, change, meaning in the whole system, the whole universe, if you were a determinist, it would be absolutely impossible. It would be impossible for change of the whole to be affected in a closed system. And that's the way a lot of us think about the physical universe. I don't. But it's the way a lot of us think about the physical universe, especially if you don't introduce quantum indeterminacies of some kind or another. It's why, you know, Newton's law, for every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction. you know, the whole point is that the overall matter and energy of the system is fixed. So, yeah, you can push off that way, if, you know, the boat from the dock. But when you step off the boat onto the dock, the boat's going to float out into the middle of the lake. And you're the only one that's going to be on the dock, not the boat. The point is that the energy is preserved in the system. The momentum is preserved in the system in one way or another. And in reality, when you extend that and sort of grasp what's actually going on, it's the overall matter and energy in the system that's sort of fixed in that way of talking about it. And I know I'm being overly simplistic. But in mathematical terms, you know, it's like saying, okay, I have 180 over here and zero over there, or I have 90 over here and 90 over there. I moved 90, but 90 are still over there. I still have the same 180. I have 445s or 920s or 181s. I've still got 180. It's never changing from that. You've always got 180, whatchamacallits, regardless of what you did in dividing them up, and that's what change looks like in a determinist's way of thinking about it. You move things around. It's still change, though. It's still change within a deterministic system. So, you know, to preview some application that we could talk about in a few minutes, we probably ought to think of our relational systems in the same way we would think of the universe in that way. And again, I'm not a determinist, but I mean, I think I argue for this as much as anybody I know who does so, especially regarding churches. So I'll give you an example of what I mean. You realize what I'm saying. I'm saying when you look at the universe and you move a particle out and you say, I've changed the universe. In reality, you moved a particle around, but it's still in the universe, right? So you still have the overall same number of particles. I know it's not just about particles. It's energies and particle and a bunch of stuff. But the point is, it's always the same. And I'm saying in the experience of my life, it's very much the same in terms of relationships. You have these constancies in life that just don't go away. So in my church, as an example, when people realized, I've told this story a long time ago, but when people realized at my church, when I pastored a church for almost 20 years in Arlington, loved being there, still love the people, I still stay in contact with a lot of the people, and I'm just grateful for the experience. The point is, as I look back on it, we had kind of a rough go for a few years. At the first, you know, it's all honeymoon and glory and, oh, look at this young pastor that we have, and everybody's super happy, right? I was super happy. And then after about 2 years, and then again at 5, and finally at about 7 years, three different times it kind of came in surges, a certain number of people would say, oh, I think he's going to stay. I think that means I'm not, you know, because they, you know, I mean, again, a new thing is nice, but you can get tired of it, or you can realize that it's not all you thought it was going to be. And I wasn't all that people thought I was going to be, for sure. So I don't even blame the people who made these decisions to leave. But whatever, they, you know, there were times when they would leave. And so we would have one person leave, or we would have a family of six leave. And it would be like, you know, it's hurtful when you're a young pastor. You think it's about you, and you don't realize people just have lives, and they're trying to make the best decisions they can, whatever. So you get past that as you get older. But, when you're young, it hurts, so it hurt. But I realized after only two or three incidents like this that, oh, this group of families is leaving, or this little group of people, or this Sunday school class seems unhappy and most of them are leaving or something, that when that would happen, the very next week, the same number of people would show up from nowhere. Not like they knew them or knew what was going on in our church, but, hey, there's some empty pews, and lo and behold, there's some people walking in the back door who are going to sit in those pews, and look at that, you know, they're single, and so is the person who left, or this is a family of six, and so is the family that left. And I'm not kidding, one for one, when somebody would leave, somebody would take their place, and they would just fit in. Now, I don't believe people are interchangeable. I believe in the dignity of human existence and not the price of human existence. So people are not exchangeable like that. I'm not saying that, but I'm saying the system was remarkably stable, despite the changes in personalities that were involved. And people are very much the same way. And by the way, that's why so often you'll see a person end a relationship because of a problem, only to find another relationship with exactly the same problem. And I mean, I see it constantly. You are bound to have seen that yourself. That's what I'm talking about. So even if you believe in determinism, which is it's not an unreasonable position to hold. I don't hold it, don't agree with it, would love to have a long discussion and argument about it. You think I am now. This is nothing. This is just grazing the top of the topic. But the point is, I don't hold the view, but I respect the view. I understand where it comes from. One of the reasons I respect it is because the evidence for it is so strong in the way we actually live our lives and experience our lives. But here's the thing that's true for everyone, determinist or not. We are almost never, and in fact, I could say we are never, and we are never, but I'm going to say it this way just to be polite. We are almost never dealing with the entirety of a system, whether closed or otherwise. Whether you're a determinist or not a determinist, you are never dealing with the whole system. That means, therefore, that we can experience real change within our known world, the way we used to talk about the world, you know, within our known world. But I mean your known world. I mean the world in which everything about your life is as fixed as you can know it, regardless of the rest of the debate about a causally closed universe, whether naturalistically or materialistically or theistically, or about determinism, even if God is the determining factor. Regardless of what you think about all of that, you can deal with change because you don't own the whole system. It's the same reason, exactly the same reason. So a little metaphor here, work with me to get what I'm talking about. It's the same reason I can't break the laws of physics. You know, every action has an equal and opposite reaction. I can't break the laws of physics and move my car without it moving the world in the opposite direction. So you'd think I could never get my car to go anywhere. But I can move my car precisely because it is so seemingly inconsequential in the grander scheme of the massive Earth. Did I cause the Earth to rotate a little slower when I drove to the east or rotate a little faster when I drove to the west? I did. Did you get to measure that? Absolutely not. I don't care how fine your instrument is. It's as if I did nothing to the Earth. The point is, I can therefore make a huge change in the direction of my car, and it, for all the world, just looks like that kind of change. Ironically, and this is maybe the most important point I'll make, and the rest of what I'm going to say is out of this. Ironically, the fact that we're so insignificant in the grand scheme of things should give us a great sense of the freedom within which we actually can operate in the little lives we do have. And I'm not even saying that insultingly. Oh, your little life didn't matter. You can change whatever you want, and who's going to care? I don't mean it like that at all. In fact, you will hear. I mean, as we're going through the rest of the discussion, that's the whole point. Serious change, real change, change of the universe is at our disposal precisely because we don't grasp everything that's around us. And I'm going to do it here, Daisy. I'm going to ask you a question because my producer's always sitting over here just trying to stay awake. That's not exactly right, but fair, not fair. But I'm going to ask you a question. There's no way you know. I don't know whether you'll know the answer to this question.
Okay.
Or not, and it's okay.
Okay.
But I do owe this discussion to one person. I owe this discussion
Someone.
And so I'm giving you two tries to guess whose ideas influenced me to have this discussion. You get two tries. Mm-hmm. You're the one person who might know. But I don't know. I don't know whether you do or not. Who do you think influenced this?
Change, determinism.
No, I don't think you'll get it that way.
Okay.
It's just people who are influential.
Okay.
On me. All who've right. changed me.
People
who make
changed
me think about
you.
The world differently. Who do you think?
I'm going to guess your wife.
That's one. That's a good guess.
Because
she did not provoke this discussion.
Thank God Almighty has helped you change.
Many, many, many different times in many different ways.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay.
It's a different woman.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Oh, it's your second love.
Now, to be clear with the audience, she's dead.
Yes, so, she is dead.
Yes.
It's a joke. Mm-hmm. But I did say second because Jen
yes,
is first.
Yeah, you're right.
But gosh, her name escapes me. She wrote...
You got it. Her first name is Hannah.
Yes.
Hannah Arendt.
Sorry. Yes, Hannah
That's
Arendt.
That's exactly right. So, no, I don't... I don't expect you to know her name. I don't expect anyone to. By the way, it is a weird name to try to remember just because of the way it's pronounced and spelled and so forth. But... such a great thinker, and it is true. I'm constantly reading new things from her and trying to reprocess old things from her. And I'm teaching a class right now that made me look back at The Human Condition, a book I did 2 or 3 episodes on the basis of that book, and it provoked a recognition of this fact that I hadn't paid attention to in as much detail as I should have when I read it the first time. That it really is true. One of the things that gives us freedom as human beings is the fact that we're not in control of the entire universe. And it's not for the simple reason that you would say, well, then the universe doesn't care. You get away with little changes, and the universe doesn't notice. No. Not for that reason at all. I'm talking real change. I'm talking significant input into the universe. Why does that even exist for us? And so I just wanted to make sure and give credit where credit's due with Hannah Arendt. So the way I want to approach the question with you is by saying, what kind of change is it that you think we should be looking for? And I'm saying that. What kind of change should we be looking for? So an overly simplified example of the options for the kind of change we can look for, and this is overly simplified, I know it, but it does give a perspective on something that we could narrow down to say, well, this is the way you ought to pursue change, this way or that way. But I can use this to make the point that both kinds of change can be valid, but they are different. So let's take an alcoholic, just a person with an addiction, but I'm just going to choose an alcoholic. And a person who has an alcoholic knows that they want to change. They don't want to be addicted anymore, or they want to get past the point of being controlled by their addiction, by alcohol. And so there are two different options on how this happens. I know people who are both kinds. I know people who have been alcoholics, and some who would still say they're alcoholics even though they don't drink anymore, who have succeeded in their own eyes, in their own description. They've succeeded in overcoming that addiction by avoiding alcohol. So they avoid bars. They don't go to parties where there's going to be a lot of drinking. They just changed all their behaviors to keep them away from what they know could be a really bad stumbling block for them. I had a friend like this for a long time who, even when other people would say, well, I think it's okay to drink, he would say to them, I wish you wouldn't say that around me because it doesn't help me. I know how easily I can slip back into it. Doesn't make him right regarding them. I'm not saying his condemnation is right, but I am saying that's how concerned he was to stay away from the influence of alcohol. And to this day, I believe he's had success with that, by the way. And this is more than 2 decades ago that I'm talking about. So, there's that approach. And then there's the other approach, which is in some way or another, developing the self-control that's strong enough that that person doesn't even need to avoid bars. And I know a person like this. I mean, completely given over to the abuse of the substance. And after they came to Christ, and this was a conversion story for him, after they came to Christ, just no desire, just did not want it anymore. And part of that was, making a commitment and then coming to Christ, and part of it is just the power that God has to bring change in people. And some people, might look at that and think, well, the change in the person who actually doesn't want it anymore and can't be tempted anymore is better than the other. I don't know that that's what we want to say. I don't think that one is supposed to be seen as better than the other. We might be tempted to say, now I'm not saying all of this to avoid the idea that we are looking for a certain kind of change. We are. We'll come back to that at the end of the discussion today. But for this moment, I just want to make the point, I'm not sure we should look at either of those people and say, ooh, he did the better kind of change. And he, it's the best he could do, but it's not what we all want to look for. So we might be tempted to say that the person who can resist temptation, even in the bar, is actually stronger than the other. But we'd be ignoring all kinds of information, which, just like the known universe, we don't know as much about it as we think we do. we'd be ignoring all kinds of information that's unavailable to us, which had the greater proclivity to addiction to begin with. What were the circumstances that provoked binges on the part of one or the other of those people? Or are there compensations for the behavior that, you know, some kind of substitution in place of one or the other? I don't know. I don't know any of that. So why am I over here evaluating or judging which one of those changes is better? I wouldn't. Not just in the people, but I'm talking about the kind of change itself. The point of the metaphor is that there really are just two ways for a system to change so that the experience of the individual really is different, sort of like you really move the car, right? So one is that the stimuli or circumstance or context or other factors that were external to the person change. Oh, okay, well, I'm not an alcoholic anymore. Why not? Well, there's no alcohol. You know, that's not available anymore. Oh, okay, well, I can see how that could help. Or, second, the individual or the character or the discipline or the proclivity or the interest or internal factors in that person change. They themselves change. Those are the two options, inside or outside, right? I mean, it's kind of describing the whole universe. So, of course, those are the two options that are there. So let's use Paul, you know, simple couple of simple examples that are well known. Use Paul as an example of both kinds of change to realize that they're both pretty close to the same thing in believers. So when you look at change internally, I'm going to start backwards from how I described them a moment ago, starting on the inside, change of self. And this is sort of a stoic approach, not in the contemporary emotional, you know, character style of the way we use the word today, but in the philosophical sense, what the Stoics actually taught of change in the self. You can't change the world. It's determined. It's fixed. But you can change how you think about the world and how you respond to it. In that sense, Philippians 4 describes Paul doing exactly that, you know, in anticipating or having received this gift from the Philippians. His response is to say, I rejoiced in the Lord greatly when you revived your concern for me. You were concerned for me, but you didn't have opportunity. But now, you know, now you have, and you've sent me a gift. Now, not that I'm speaking of being in need, because I've learned in whatever situation I am. See, context doesn't change. Circumstance doesn't change. Outside doesn't change. I've learned in whatever situation I am to be content. I know how to be brought low. I know how to abound in any and every circumstance. I have learned the secret of facing plenty, hunger, abundance, need. I can do all those things through him who strengthens me. Now pause before we draw any really radical conclusions here, but it is obvious he's saying, I found internally the place where I need to be centered so that I can respond to any situation in the way that I'm supposed to respond. That's internal, not external. If you think about external stimuli and the desire for those to change, then it's easy to think of the thorn in the flesh. Paul wants the circumstance to change, and so he wants the thorn to go away. So a thorn was given me in the flesh. This is 2 Corinthians 12, if you don't know it. A messenger of Satan to harass me, to keep me from becoming conceited. Three times I pleaded with the Lord about this. Make this go away, that it should leave me. But he said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. Therefore, Paul responds by saying exactly the same kind of statement that he makes in Philippians 4, but he says, therefore, I will boast all the more gladly of my weaknesses. So now I'm okay with being weak so that the power of Christ may rest upon me for the sake of Christ. Then I'm content with weaknesses, insults, hardships, persecutions, calamities. You can hear how similar it is to Philippians 4. When I'm weak, then I am strong. In this one, though, what we realize is that what he wanted was for the thorn to go away. He wanted that circumstance to change. But the circumstance that changed for him was receiving God's grace. Now, it involved both the grace being present and him receiving it, because it's not like God suddenly emerged with grace. Oh, that's right. But Paul receives it in a way that gives him peace. So what we ultimately realize in Philippians 4 and 2 Corinthians 12 is that either kind of change in a believer comes from God, and it depends on him as its ultimate source. It's God who changes circumstances, and it's God who changes us so that we can respond to the circumstances. That's fine. So we establish that, and that's good, and we realize we are dependent on him. And I'm not trying to dismiss that like it's unimportant. Oh, that's fine. I mean, you know, it involves God and grace and whatever. I'm not trying to dismiss it like that. I'm saying fundamentally, it's always dependent on God. He's the source of everything. If you're a theist, I mean, he's the reason we exist. So it's not hard for us to acknowledge that. But at the same time, there's still something that sets internal change apart from external change that makes it different. But it entails acknowledging that first statement that both kinds of change come from God. So what's the difference? Well, in Paul's second case, the one in 2 Corinthians, the circumstance he wanted to change was the thorn, but the circumstance that actually did change was God's grace. In Paul's first case, the circumstance we expect him to want changed is his deprivation. Well, I was doing without, y'all sent me a gift, and hallelujah. I mean, I'm finally sleeping on a pillow, you know, that. But that's not what he says. He says, I'm not speaking in respect of want. I'm grateful for the gift you sent, but I've learned when I have an abundance and when I have nothing to be content with what Christ has given me. So he had already released concern about whether his circumstance was going to change before the Philippians sent their gift. So in terms of happiness and satisfaction and peace and contentment, that's the whole game. But hear me carefully. In terms of purpose, that's not the whole game. There's more involved than that. Yes, for the things individuals are seeking, which in the Greek world, that's what their entire philosophy had been about. And as Paul addresses the Philippians, who are very much Hellenistic, when he addresses the Philippians and says, this is how you find the things you were looking for in your Epicureanism or in your Stoicism, then he gives them the answer that they were looking for and is a part of the answer that God wants us to have, to be content, which we will find in Christ. But there is more to human existence than happiness or contentment. There is something also about purpose. And nothing in Scripture leads us to be satisfied as if we're completed with contemplative isolation, for example. We're made to serve. Before the fall in cultivation, since the fall in laboring and our toil in making the dominion that we exercise and building the wisdom that we have to craft things with our hands and in acting, which is what we do among others when we're serving them or loving them. All of those things are a part of what we're given to do in the world that goes beyond whether we're content or satisfied or anything else. So I want to get back to external change in that context, which if you listened to the episodes that we did from Hannah Arendt's The Human Condition, you know what I'm talking about when I say laboring and making and acting and how important all of that is to who we are and what we are as human beings. So how do we get back to external change here, and what is it supposed to mean? And now we're headed toward the close here. So the place where we hit the brick wall on being able to do things of any kind or to be able to change anything of any kind is our inherent limitation, and that is that we're not sovereign. We're simply not omnipotent, and therefore we are not sovereign. We like the idea of sovereignty. We'd love to believe that we're sovereign, but nothing about us is sovereign. No matter how much free will I believe I'm exercising, the fact that I don't have all power means I'm not actually free. I can't just fly because I want to and so on. Not that that's a goal of mine, but you understand the point. The horizon, and this is, it's not just that, not that we're not, you know, that we're not omnipotent. It's also that we're not omniscient. The horizon beyond which we are blind to the end of our acts. You understand what I mean? The horizon beyond which we can see what the conclusion of our actions is going to be. That's what I'm talking about. The horizon beyond which we are blind to the end of our acts is barely past the end of our own nose. We don't know what's going to result from all of the things that we do. And in actuality, that point of weakness, that I don't have all the power to do everything I would want to do, and that I don't have the knowledge to grasp what the consequence of all of my actions is going to be, that right there is where our purpose and faith are both realized. It's a stunning irony that we are most powerful in our influence in the world and the change that we make because we are too weak to control what comes from it. So this is what I mean by that. When we act, we lose control of the outcome immediately. And I mean this, I could go on and on in Scripture with one example after another exactly how this happens. But we lose control of the outcome immediately. It's like throwing a ball, and once it's out of your hand, it's just going to go where it's going to go. Every ball we throw is like that. We can't control where it's going. We can't withdraw the action either. That's the important part. It's out there in the world, and it's going to do what it's going to do. But that means we also encounter, in that moment, the difference that we're making in the world. So the T.S. Eliot poem, The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock, just so perfect a poem. I mean, every time I read it, I just think to myself, oh, if I could just do one thing like that in my entire life. Just such a great poem. Anyway, in the middle of it, he has these three lines. They're toward the conclusion of the poem, not at the conclusion. But he has these three lines, and they're surrounded by pressures that say the opposite. Everything in the poem is ironic, and it's, you know, about a person who's not doing this. I get that. But the point is, the description is just so perfect of a person introducing this kind of change into the world, what it does to hit these are the lines, to have bitten off the matter with a smile, to have squeezed the universe into a ball, to roll it towards some overwhelming question. That squeezing the universe into a ball, which I've talked about in another episode, I've talked about this line, because it's so such a great description that when we introduce anything into the world, when we actually do something, and this is when we were talking about it before, just do something, that when we do something, it introduces a permanent and expansive, persistent change into the universe. And the expansive and persistent nature of changing the universe through our works, through the things we make, through the acts we commit in relating to other people, it's intimidating. You know, you're doing something that you can't take back. It permanently influences the world. But on the positive side, it's, you know, capable of bringing incalculable reward. And on the most negative side, puts us at, this is the most negative you can get with it. It puts us at the mercy of God, the only sovereign, the only one who actually is omnipotent and omniscient, knowing all things and able to do anything. It puts us at his mercy, but it also puts us at the mercy of other people. It puts us at the mercy of forgiveness, not just from God, but from other people who are just as non-sovereign as we are. So what we experience in anticipation is exactly the same dependency on faith. Every time we make a plan or a promise of some kind. So if I do an action, I'm saying, I've made a permanent dent in the world. And maybe the only thing I can rely on for that to become something good is God's mercy and the forgiveness of the people I've dented, right? That's just the truth. If I look toward the future and the things I haven't done yet, the same space exists when I make a promise. And I can't control the external circumstances that are required for me to complete or a plan or to fulfill a promise that I've made. But we still commit. And that doesn't mean I have to say, I promise, or I swear, or I sign the contract. I might, but I might just do it the way Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount, let your yes be yes. If I say I'm going to do something, I'm making a promise. And I can't control the circumstances that will or won't allow me to keep that promise. So when we make plans, we express a lot of different ways. When we make plans or promises and then they work out, we are quietly, maybe we're not even aware of this reality, we're falling repeatedly, almost constantly, on the faithful mercies of God that he just gave us the environment that allowed us to complete what we said we were going to do. But when we are wrenched free from those plans and made incapable of fulfilling our pledges, we have nowhere to go but into faith. Confronted by our lack of sovereignty, confused by God's turn from where we thought he was going to go, not that he literally turned, but in our understanding, he didn't do the thing we thought he was going to do. The Psalms are filled with Israel asking God why he's turned, why he isn't doing what they thought he was going to do. In those moments, when something changed and we weren't able to fulfill our promise, we only have two things to say. To God, we can say, how long, Lord, until you make, if it's a wrong, right? You know, how long until this changes? And then with Job to say, you know, even though he slays me, yet I will trust him. My point is, we're not sovereign, but the fact that we're not sovereign is part of the reason we're able to make such profound change in the world. Because we do throw our actions into the world. We do throw our relations into the world. We do throw our choices into the world, our promises into the world. And they leave us vulnerable. They leave us vulnerable in need of grace and forgiveness and help and all of the things that we wish we didn't have to rely on others for, but of course make us part of the community. That's what makes us part of the community. So in all of this, I'm not saying to you, you can't do anything. I'm saying to you, you can. So go change the world, because the whole world changes when you just squeeze that universe into the little ball of the decision you're able to make. Go change the world. Labor. Do the things that maintain the world, that keep the systems going. Make, produce the things that God's given you wisdom and skill to make so that they persist in the world for other people to act around, and then act among other people and do things. But in doing all of it, trust the only one who's actually sovereign. And at the same time, forgive those around you who have to do the same thing you do. And, you know, whether they actually do or not, forgive. But in all your changing, don't forget where to start, which is with you. And, well, I suppose if it's good for the goose, then it's good for me.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.